Hey now, it is Dan Eberhardt here with the Growing the Future podcast, and of course, also president of Eberhardt Ag Solutions. And I want to give you a quick audio intro to Corey Wilness's Growing the Future podcast. This was episode 3 for us, and I thought there was a lot of good agronomy in here. But before I get into that, I want to share with you a quote that I chose about Corey. I think it's very apt. Most people are other people. Their thoughts are someone else's opinions. Their lives a mimicry. Their passions a quotation. Oscar Wilde. So that might seem a little bit deep, but what I'm talking about here is the fact that most people only think what they're told to think. They don't think about what they're thinking about. Ugh, if that makes any sense. But the reality is Corey Wilness is in the minority of people who's willing to think for himself and really come up with his own conclusions. And to me, he's a thought leader in agronomy in hashtag Western Canadian Ag. And he's not afraid to share those opinions and defend those opinions. And so whether you agree or not, you got to admit he's really sparked a lot of conversation. And I really enjoyed talking to Corey. I'm fascinated by precision agriculture. I'm fascinated by the way he layers together his maps into something that the agronomy crew can take and make actionable in the world. You know, I love his sulfur strategy, of course, which lines up very well with ours. And, you know, I'm interested in anybody who's scaling a business. And certainly Corey has been busy scaling an agronomy business, which in itself is quite an accomplishment because agronomy is such a personal service, such a people service for him to scale this over a wide swath of acres and integrate it into other people's business. Speaks to, you know, A, his competency on the technology side, but B, obviously he's getting the right people in place that can work with the technology and bring it to the producer, because to me that's an extremely personal relationship when a producer has an agronomist. That is very personal because you're literally making decisions that affect your bottom line with that individual. Corey and I covered a whole bunch of areas, water management, fertility management, big picture industry stuff, of course, precision farming and agronomy. And we really got to know more about Corey and his company. So if you like agronomy, if you've been an agronomy nerd, this will serve you well. And Corey and I are planning on a number of things to collaborate on together in the future. So I really appreciate getting to know Corey over time. And I like to say that we've become friends. And certainly someone that I respect in the industry, and it was a pleasure and an honor to have you on the show, Corey. So with that, I would say enjoy the episode. And as we say here on the Growing the Future podcast, one good conversation can shift the tides of tomorrow. Make sure to check out eberhardtagsolutions.ca and enjoy this episode, no charge.
The Growing the Future podcast is brought to you by Eberhardt Ag Solutions. Join us as we talk to top entrepreneurs about their methods of obtaining success in their endeavors. And now, your host, Dan Eberhardt.
My job is just talking, sounding super intelligent, having amazing guests on, and being a really big star in the ag industry.
Well, Corey was the star of your music video there.
Yeah, well, I couldn't help but bring in Corey.
How did that go at the Sask Young Ag thing? What kind of response did you get?
It was good. You know, it was really interesting dynamic. Putting that video out there and then just having to like hit send on it, because it's just like, what are people going to think in the mind that like your primitive brain is kind of like, are people going to laugh at me? And then, you know, our people think our company is a joke, and then people won't buy from us, and then I won't have a business, and then I won't be able to support my family, and then I'm going to die. It's kind of like the fear of social media, right? But it went over really well. It was really hilarious, the response on the video. The presentation itself, I think, was really great. I really support that organization, and hearing your ad and, you know, having Brad Wall in there and just the under 40 crowd where you can really like turn the jets on.
Yeah.
I think that's great. Were you involved with that at all, or?
I've spoke there twice actually. And had some staff that were in Sask Young Ag. I'm not sure if they still are, but yeah, I mean, we have clients in there and yeah, it's, I think it's great. I think young people that are what you might call leaders and they want to invest in something, it's a good group, right? It's, they're young, but they're professional and they're, you know, they are trying to make a difference in each other's business, and there seems to be a respect among them. And so we do need young people to step up and, you know, be the future leaders too. And this is, that's a really good, in my opinion, really good network to do that. I think they're doing a good job.
So what I find, Corey, is like people are attracted to what you're doing. What do you think it is that you've built in the company and the culture that really attracts people to come work with you?
Well, I think young people are into doing new things, right? Trying new things. They want to learn new ways of doing things. They want to apply the knowledge that they learn. They like being empowered to do the right thing, right? So at our company, I mean, we don't have a sales department. It's just everyone's an agronomist or a techie geek. And so everything that we're doing is very much directly practicing agronomy at, you know, at a micromanaged level. So there, the amount of things you learn, the amount of improvements you can make and work with technology every day, that's what young people are looking for, I think. It's just a kind of a new style of career.
Well, and I think once you start taking a look under the hood in agriculture, if you weren't familiar with it before, there's just so many amazing things that are happening now that people can specialize in that weren't available 10 or 20 years ago. I think you had to be a real jack of all trades on the farm not too long ago, and now, you know, in the agricultural industry, there's more and more unique opportunities. So I think a lot of people are familiar with you, Corey, from your speaking and social media. But if you were to give me the kind of the elevator pitch on what you guys do, I mean, there's lots of people doing agronomy in the business. What's different about you and your company that you would share with somebody on a little elevator ride?
Well, our agronomy services company, Crop Row Consulting, has its roots in full farm agronomy services. So it's typically referred to most people as crop scouting services with a lot of extra management. But the major growth part of our business is our precision ag services, primarily variable rate fertilizer and seed, through our unique mapping methods, which are known as SWAT maps or soil, water, and topography maps. And that's what makes us different. And that would be the growing part of our business.
The deal with this SWAT maps? Like, what's the journey been like? When did you start doing it? How did it come about? Is it something that you just saw a need for and you developed a tool because you needed the tool? How did that come about?
Well, when I got my degree in 96, consulting was the thing I wanted to do, and I was very interested in precision ag. So I got involved with a project out of the Melfort Research Station with Northeast Ag Research Foundation. And it was a group of producers with yield mapping on their combines. All of them had it. And one of the producers, his name is Dennis McIntosh, had his full farm under variable rate at that time using his own method. So what we did was, as a group, we funded about 5 years of variable rate research. So we did grid sampling. Of course, we had yield map data. We had pestle weather stations. And then we spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on soil tests, had a lot of government grants. And the goal was to learn fertilizer response and what type of mapping solution would best fit, for variable rate applications. And so at that time, I guess you could say that we came up with topography and water were two of the most important factors. But at that time, there was no way to get a map of that. It was before its time. So,
in what year was it, Corey?
That was 2003.
2003, okay.
Yeah. So then I started my own independent consulting company in 2003, and then for years just beat the paths in the precision ag industry, trying to find ways to scale that type of a mapping solution. And then at 2008, it was born, and we, you know, that was the first year we offered SWAT maps commercially. Satellite imagery is fantastic for scouting or in-season applications, or, you know, learning where insects and diseases and weeds and salinity and sand, like seeing all the effects of it. But it was never, in our opinion, and IHARF kind of found the same thing, it was never a solid base layer for fertility. So that's how we ended up starting on SWAT maps in 2008.
Well, you guys aren't just fighting like space wars, you know, it's with the satellites, so to speak. Like, you've got an army of people on the ground, like in trucks, like contacting the soil, like making things happen on a really physical level. I think that's one of your distinctions.
Well, electrical conductivity is a relatively inexpensive sensor, and it does a good job of what I call measuring subsurface variability. You know, it's influenced by texture, solutes in water and water, and all those things are combined, so it makes the maps a little complex. But we've just found it's a very critical layer to learn what's going on underneath the ground. By collecting accurate elevation data, then you can model where's the water flowing, where does it sit in flood areas, where does it, what areas are shedding water, and along with a topography model, integrate all those things together so you could, you know, delineate the different areas of the fields differently.
Sorry, you're using a Varis or EM38? I guess they're similar, but.
Well, actually, we've used all the sensors. We've had Varis machines. We currently have a fleet of EM38s and three topsoil mappers. That's the GeoProspectors unit from Europe.
Oh, okay.
The type of instrument you use, it doesn't really matter. It's just whatever instrument works best in your area and for the type of equipment that you're pulling it with. And, you know, an EC map is an EC map. There's nothing different about them, really.
Well, I think one of the cool things you guys have done is made it so that it's kind of automated in the way that if you're dragging behind a implement that's already doing work, you're collecting a huge amount of data without any extra work, and I think that's critical to the success of it. Are you taking those conductivity maps then and just using that to create targeted areas for soil zoning to have better information, kind of shine a flashlight in the dark where to go, or is that more part of the whole integration with the other layers?
Yeah, no, there's probably, you know, on an average field, there's probably 50 or 60 different, what I'd call files in the directory. Like an EC map on its own is just one of them, right? So I'll just give you an example of when you're modeling, you want to model depressions in the field. They could be depressions that shed water, like that they don't hold water, they don't flood. They can be depressions that flood, and they can be saline depressions, you know, and so we would zone those all differently. So you need, like, electrical conductivity map doesn't tell you where water sits in the field, right? You need a topography map for that. So it's a combination of using different layers, and then we have our own proprietary software module that we've built to put layers together.
So is the topography and the water component much more pertinent and critical in areas like where you are and where we farm at Langenberg, given how we farm the hills and, like you say, depressions or all kinds of different things? What about the plains of Regina? Is it the same mix of elements of information you're combining to reach a conclusion, or do you adjust that?
Yeah, it's a good question. It would be adjusted quite a bit depending on the area and the type of soils. So Regina has very little difference in soil texture. However, when you EC map it, so then what the EC map will show is where the water is shedding and where it's collecting. And it will also show areas that have had historical erosion versus areas that have collected the soil from historical erosion. Okay, so that's generally the two little things you'll find from EC maps. The dominant factor in those kinds of soils is the water layer. Okay. So in pothole country on 160 acres in a wet year, you've got 30 acres of potholes. Drive down to Regina on 160 acres, and what do you got? 30 or 40 acres of cattails. So I always say it doesn't matter. People say, well, I don't have any topographic variability. Water still sits somewhere, right? And wherever water is moving, it's taking solutes with it. It affects the crop, right? The drier areas in a wet year in a Regina field, you grow 70 or 80 bushel canola, like on a, you know, if you're getting rain in a wet year, if you're getting moisture in a wet year, it'll be the dry areas of the field that are the highest yielding, and the areas that collect water will be dead. And that'll completely flip in a dry year. The hills will be the poorer yielding, and the water collecting areas will be your high yielding canola. So the water maps are driving everything. That's the overriding factor. It doesn't matter what part of North America you're in. The water map is the key factor.
You think that's the biggest part of the pie chart for decision making is the water and the topography?
Absolutely. Like, yeah. Unless you have perfectly tile drained fields and you're irrigating, like you're controlling the water, in other words, if it's just natural, it's water is the number one variability factor and yields between years.
You guys haven't tiled everything at Melfort yet? Come on.
Well, it's coming. Like, there's definitely people tiling, and for a good reason. You know, land is expensive, and if you're, some of your best soils in a wet year are drowning out, and most people still farm through them. So yeah, people are spending a couple $100 an acre on inputs nowadays, and the value of land, tiling is going to be a big thing.
Yeah, I think the economic threshold and the work that we did there and the water management days at Precision Land Solutions made a pretty elaborate calculator that was, we had some pretty smart people from the farming community that were consultants built that thing. And the economic threshold at which it makes more sense to tile than it does to purchase additional land is $2,500. And it was very interesting, like all the ROI on stuff like that. So you're talking about water being first in your diagnostic assessing tools for decision making, but that's probably not the first lever that farmers pull on. Like, that's not the first thing they do is water management on their land, is it? Or is it moving on?
No, but we're so using the maps that we make, it's sort of what I'd call a side benefit to have layers that show where water is collecting and saline areas, which you could, you know, you could tile these certain areas of the field. We're using that information to make people's variable rate maps and prescriptions and decide where to sample.
Yeah, so it's a sidebar. You can use this information because we have topography and water flow, and you make some beautiful maps. It just blows a person's mind when you look at where the water flows. I mean, those are one of the most beautiful things in nature, is like those water maps. I just love them. But yeah, so you're saying it's a side benefit. You could take those maps and use them for water management, engineered design, but that's not their primary intent.
No. Very few people are hiring us to do that. Like, we do some of that because we can give them the layers that we need, but 99% of our work is all collecting the water maps for variable rate fertilizer and seed applications.
So you're still saying variable rate, eh? But guys have a lot of objections to variable rate. Like, it doesn't work. It doesn't pay. What do you say to people like that?
Not if you don't know how to do it.
School me. I can't wait.
I mean, I'll use a good example of your area of the world, Langenberg. That's kind of like pothole country, right?
Yep.
So what it's going to, just a real simple picture here is, I bet you all your hills are low in phosphorus and sulfur. Consistently, they'll be the most efficient parts of the field,
right?
And because water is running downhill and historical erosion and even natural processes have, you've got more organic matter and a deeper topsoil in your depressions, plus they're collecting water, so it'll have your highest phosphorus and your highest sulfur, and in most cases those areas will be highly productive with just maintenance applications. So you go out and flat rate 10,000 acres, right? And I bet you a third of the farm is these hills. Why would you be spending $30 an acre or more on phosphorus and sulfur in depressions when it probably only needs 15? Why wouldn't you spend $45 on the tops of the hills where the areas are deficient in phosphorus and sulfur? And if you get rain, you're going to grow way more bushels on all those acres. That's a simple, very simple, and it costs you nothing. That's just taking your existing fertilizer budget and reallocating it across a farm.
Yeah.
We do it all the time on that type of ground. I mean, that's probably the easiest way to make money in pothole country.
So what is the argument? I mean, I've heard it from, you know, even some sophisticated agronomy companies where they don't even have variable rate component because they just don't believe in it. Where do you think the disconnect is between the opportunity and the way people perceive it?
Well, it's a whole industry problem. You know, that's, I mean, I'm very active in practically every university and college in Western Canada trying to get them to have a precision ag program. Like last year, there wasn't a single provincial specialist in three provinces. There's not a single precision ag prof or precision ag class in three provinces, much less a degree or a diploma opportunity. So we have zero research that's of any good because there's no master students, there's no PhDs. Like, where do we expect all this knowledge to come from? Who's teaching people? We don't do any real research. So there's the core root of the problem there. So there's people like us that are learning by trial and error, right? Learning on the fly, because there's no one's probably invested more in doing that than us. And then you have the other side of the industry, people saying, well, it doesn't work. And, you know, nobody knows what to do. It does work if you know what you're doing, right? Mm-hmm. And most people just don't want to, like, I mean, I think it's, if water drives everything, right? And if you can go out to your farm and you can dig in the dirt down and you got saline areas, how much fertilizer does that need?
Right.
You don't even need a degree to figure out that, right? We got all kinds of land around here that is 10% of its saline. And I got a map of it. So there's 10% of a guy's farm. He's not spending $100 an acre on fertilizer on. You know, and then you go to the next zone outside of those salinity areas, they're deep black soils. It's 18 inches deep of black dirt, you know, with 8% organic matter. And it's loaded with nutrients when you test it. It's a low fertilizer response area. This has been well documented. Okay. You go into the mid slopes in the field and you can tell even when you drive in there every single year in Northeast Saskatchewan, because the depressions are always too wet and the hills are not your best ground. The mid slopes are always the best ground year in, year out. They're always completely devoid of nutrients. There's hardly a mid slope location in anyone's field that's not devoid of nutrients. So, I mean, then you just plow the fertilizer on your mid slope soils. And the extreme on the other end, your high and dry soils, they could be sandy. They could be just, you know, lower organic matter hills that are decent soil. If they're sandy, you know, obviously you're not going to put a bunch of nutrients there. You know, you don't even need yield maps to go and look in the sand and see it doesn't pay to put much fertilizer there. So the problem is the industry is like waiting for someone to come up with some pinpoint accuracy, you know, put the target on the wall and hit the middle when right now we're not even hitting the dartboard. Like all we're trying to do is get better, and no one wants to use common sense and existing knowledge, you know, and come out and say, well, yeah, water, we need to know where the water is. Obviously we should know where the salinity is in a field. Obviously we should know the different soil types and textures in a field. Right. I mean, I don't understand why it's so hard for the industry to grasp, but these are essential layers. And so 99% of the people will say it doesn't work. And all they've done is made zones with the satellite image. So that's the problem.
I think you make a really good point about, you know, education in the industry. And man, it's probably time that institutions are servicing this area of the industry and the investment and the research is there. But like Alyssa, don't we have you're just at ACC. Don't we have, isn't there a program at ACC for precision farming, precision ag? I think there's
I know they have an agriculture program, but I've never heard anything about like precision, but that wasn't my program.
I think there's like a precision agriculture program. It's 1 or 2 years where they take on exactly that at ACC. Did you look at that at all, Corey? Are you familiar?
Yeah, no, you're right. And I don't know if it's still there. Pardon my ignorance, but it was definitely there a decade ago. And that's good, but I mean, it's...
We don't hear much about it anymore, though. I heard it was a pretty good program, I thought.
Yeah, and community college... Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, we have ag expert and agribusiness, and then advanced agribusness.
You know, that's the crazy part. It might not even be there anymore because probably there wasn't enough interest or something. Maybe you're right, Corey. Like, is there nothing?
Well, the thing with, if you look at colleges, the challenge is, who are the profs? Right? So you go across Western Canada.
Like what demographic are they?
No, well, where are they coming from? Because there are no PhDs in precision agriculture type stuff in Western Canada.
Yeah.
Aim one, there isn't any, right? So even all these universities and colleges are starting to develop classes and stuff. And I talk to them all. Who do they hire? Like, we haven't developed anyone.
Yeah.
To have a prof, you need someone that took their master's and then that took their PhD in something. They don't exist.
So education, not only to your customers, but for the industry in general, must be a huge thing for you. Like, and it seems like you're trying to do that, educate people. But I guess that's probably a challenge and a frustration that you got to build that as an entrepreneur in the business.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's face it. If kids come out with degrees and we're hiring them, it would be nice if they had a base knowledge of everything, right? And base knowledge taught at a professional institution, you know, it's unbiased. It's, you know, they'll be doing literature reviews and teaching them, you know, the basic fundamentals of soil fertility in a landscape or, you know, crop response to water in variable landscapes and how to look at yield maps, what you should use satellite imagery for, what you should not use it satellite imagery for. I mean, these are a lot of basic things that how can you have a 4-year degree now and not come out with these tools? I mean,
it's so weird because you think about it can't be that complicated. Like, you wouldn't necessarily have to have professors that were actually like incredibly proficient in every aspect of this, but you could facilitate learning in such a way like, hey, we're going to learn about this, research this, research that, talk to this person, you know, test this, do that. You know, it could be like a self-directed learning course where at least they get some exposure and some motivation and learning how to learn in university. I don't know. That's a very interesting point that you make, though. And it's doing a disservice to our agricultural community for sure. And the weird part is when they're talking about that supercluster, I mentioned this to Jeff Bennett, I was talking to earlier, like with this protein supercluster and stuff, they were on the presentation, they were showing the level of research in Canada. And you got to be aware of statistics. Like, I'm not sure if this is a really holistic view, but like the overall R&D in agriculture in Canada was less than Croatia. And maybe it's because we're near such a big center like the US that's doing a lot. Like, what's your opinion on the level of investment in agriculture and R&D in new areas like you're talking about, obviously, in Canada?
Yeah, well, that was my primary selling feature when I talked to the universities about it, because I'll give the example of Raj Khosla, who's the leader of the Precision Ag program at Colorado State University. They have a massive amount of projects going on with master's students there. They can't keep up to the amount of people coming to them to test their products or to test their processes, et cetera, et cetera. Right? Because people need, first of all, credible third-party sources to validate their products. But second of all, I mean, they have a lot of knowledge there and ability to save an investment company $10 million if they say, here's this new tool, you know, research it. Tell us if you think that this is a viable tool for what we say it's going to be. Have a great team like that test it and say, yeah, this thing is fantastic. Go ahead and commercialize it, or no, this thing doesn't work at all. Save yourself $10 million. Like, there's zero investment in precision ag or anything in far as ag technology coming to Canadian universities because we have nothing. We don't have any specialists. So there's no master's program. There's, what is there to do? How are you attracting money to ag tech if we have nothing?
I find it really fascinating too. I think there's a really big focus on field testing and trialing of products and stuff like that. But, you know, some of these practices can have a larger overarching impact on your bottom line than anything. Products might be just interchangeable, like products come and go, but some of these practices can make such a difference. And we don't really have any third-party data tests showing this practice of administering nutrients according to actual data is better than just wholesale broadcasting it on corner to corner. I mean, surely we're going to hit a point in agriculture where wholesale broadcasting of things in general is going to seem pretty barbaric, is my opinion, whether it's fungicide or herbicide.
Yeah.
Nutrients. Some nutrients we know are great to go on that way. I won't mention any names, but you know what I'm talking about. But other than that, like, it's going to seem barbaric when we just turn things on drive.
No, I mean, that's whatever. Let's talk about elemental sulfur for a minute.
Okay.
And I'll show you how that, as an agronomy firm, we identified places where farmers specifically should drop a sulfur-based program and start using elemental. Okay. And
you're not getting paid for this.
No, I'm not. I don't take any money from anyone. Otherwise, I can't say what I really think.
You literally wouldn't take my money because I know I'm like, you know, I'm offered it. Not that I have it. Anyways, go on.
No, I mean, elemental sulfur, period. I'm not specifically promoting your product. I didn't mention the name of a product.
We didn't.
Although there are differences in products, but we won't discuss that today.
And there's the right thing.
No, the example I want to give you is so around Star City, and as you get northeast Saskatchewan, there's a lot of the hills are sandy, okay, or sandy loam. And so they're well leached, they have low organic matter, but in northeast Saskatchewan, they get consistent amount of rain. Right? It's usually too wet, not too dry. So we can actually grow very good crops up there. And traditionally what people have done here is they put on we put on more sulfur than we need. So people do blanket applications because 20 years ago when I started as an agronomist here, I spent the first 2 years driving around people, they had sulfur deficiency on all their hills. So what happened? Everyone just upped their sulfur rates. So now they're putting on, say, 100 pounds of ammonium sulfate, putting on 24 actual S everywhere just to make sure that every part of the field has enough, right?
Every year just a canola year, Corey?
No, just in a canola year. And then 2 years later, it's probably a canola year again. They'd be putting it on again. Or some people might, you know, just put high rates on every year. But generally speaking, sulfur is over applied here, right? Because they're trying to match the sulfur recommendation to the deficient part of the field. The depressions and salinity,
right,
excuse me, do not need 24 pounds of sulfur. Okay. Right. So the challenge, here's what we found. If you have like clay loam soils, the sulfur does stick around. Even though you over apply, we found that it will stick around when you go and soil test those areas the next year, or you grow any crop, even the wheat crop the next year, you can tissue test it, you'll find decent sulfur levels there. Sulfur really isn't a problem. But those well-leached soils where water is running off or running down through the profile, we can, in the next year, in the wheat growing year, find that it's already deficient because it doesn't stick around. You get an excess 2-inch rain, your sulfate's gone. Okay, so that's where what we promote is people doing a variable rate program, but adding more sulfate sulfur to the top of a sandy hill doesn't solve anything. Because you can put 1,000 pounds on, and if it washes away, it washes away, right? So they need a slow release product that, so we've made prescriptions for elemental sulfur where on the tops of the hills, like a product like yours, you might put 250 pounds, 270 pounds. And then in the depressions with high organic matter and high sulfur release for those reasons, or and they'll probably have salinity, water collection. That's where we put on low rates, like put into the low hundreds, right? And so you'll get at least 5 years out of your program, and you're confident that you're putting more in those areas, and it's a slow release product, right? So there's a good example of, you know, we started doing one thing with the guy's precision ag program, just applying more sulfate sulfur in those areas from soil and tissue testing, found that it's not working. So you don't say that variable rate doesn't work. What you say is this isn't the right strategy for those types of soils in that environment, right?
Apologize about that.
Right? It needs to be dealt with in a different way. And so whether it's a blending of sulfate and elemental or top dressing sulfate on the other crops, like it's just the producer needs to understand over applying 1 year and expecting it to hang around for three isn't going to work. We've done that. We've been there. It doesn't work.
Well, and that's, you're probably making a larger point. I love what you're saying about elemental sulfur, obviously, and I'm passionate about it on those levels because I think it makes a lot of sense, like, you know, sandy light soils for sure, and there's other elements there too to talk about, but I think you're addressing a larger point with precision agriculture is like you need to have a visibility on some of the blind spots that might hold back the success of the program that you don't want to necessarily hold the program responsible for. And that's where I think the strong boots on the ground and the agronomy serving you guys well. That's very interesting. Are you, in a general sense, like concerned about, you know, a lot of the seed place fertilizer that's got high salt index? Is that something you guys really got your eye on, or up in your area, you don't find that's an issue with users?
Yeah, I think in general, there's a trend to moving away from it. You know, I mean, there's been tons of research on that type of stuff where we know we're getting too hot, we're pushing things, and, you know, a lot of people, as they're making the decisions on new equipment now, it's definitely coming into the discussion, right? Like, how are you going to get all the product that you need on without having to push so hard in the seed row? And so, I mean, there's lots of different ways of doing that, obviously, and I mean, elemental sulfur is one of them, mid-row banding, side banding, and, you know, even floating is making a large, you know, inroads into the market in general. Just a lot of people don't like it when we say that, but I mean, the reality is it's, you know, you can speed up seeding, you know? So, I mean, sulfur, I mean, back to the topic of sulfur, it's a bulky product. It's a bulky product, slows down the drill, and everyone hates it in their drill. Like, I mean, it builds up in the lines, you know, you get plugging issues, and it's high humidity. I mean, they're
pretty corrosive.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I'm not against using ammonium sulfate. There's lots of producers that still do that. I'm just saying there's lots of different ways of, you know, getting products out of the seed row that, and most people are doing that, I guess.
Are you guys really focused on phos or nitrogen, potash? What do you think producers need the most help with?
Well, in general, it would be nitrogen, phosphorus.
Mm-hmm.
Sulfur would be a close third.
Mm-hmm.
And potassium is probably fairly distant in the need for variable rate in Western Canada from what I see. You know, like there'll be some areas with peat soils and a lot of sand where varying potassium is very important, but in general, nitrogen and phosphorus are the big ones, and sulfur you know, should not be ignored, as it's probably the one that's most incorrectly applied and most over applied, in my opinion.
So what do you do with guys on their nitrogen? How do you help them manage? Because nitrogen's got to be $50 to $75 an acre expense for most guys, right?
Yeah, I guess it all depends on your crop mix, you know, how aggressive people are with their yield goals and protein goals and things like that. So there's really no
hard. Are you guys doing like a reverse engineering of yield targets and then your fertility back from there? Is that a thing in your program, or how do you look at that?
Well, we definitely do the soils up approach, right? So, or learn what we feel the productivity would be of the various soils, what the moisture levels are, and then establish yield potentials after that. So, you know, I guess the challenge with using a yield approach is, my question always is to the producer, is going to be dry, average, or wet this year? Because that's going to affect what I'm going to recommend. So using a yield goal approach is, it's kind of difficult. I think, you know, you're better off to know what the yield goals are and then look across the field and say, well, where's the best place to, you know, invest in fertilizer to meet those goals? And, you know, I kind of alluded to it early in our conversation where, and if you go in the northern Saskatchewan, northeast Saskatchewan, where it's really wet, it's almost a completely different philosophy than Swift Current, where it's typically dry.
Right.
So it's, you can't come up with any hard and fast answers for that. It's in Swift Current, we might put most of the fertilizer in the depressions. In northeast Saskatchewan, that won't be how it is, because there's lots of native fertility there and, you know, they tend to flood out. So field and area specific.
You guys deal over a very large geography, eh?
Yeah, well, our own agronomy services company is primarily Saskatchewan, a little bit in Manitoba and Alberta. But we work with agronomists that lots of people are using the SWAT maps system and process now, like in the United States and Ontario. And so, I mean, we get to hear a lot of their stories and see what they're doing too. So there is a larger network of people out there learning and trying stuff that we also get to benefit from.
Are you relearning a lot of your thinking given how different areas are? Or is this sort of universal principles applying? You just got to fit into the situation.
Some things would be generally applicable, but I mean, there's areas that you start working to, like say, and you get into Minnesota and when they got sugar beets and, you know, Red River Valley soils and the rotation is with corn and, you know, soybeans and stuff. It's like, you know, mostly that would be for me just, you know, here's what I think that the SWAT map would look like. And they have to take the agronomy and go from there, because we learn a lot from those people. We would never tend to be an expert in that area. We just don't know the environment, don't know the crop types and how things respond. So, you know, we're just then just part of the basically say a map making expert supporting them on what we're finding there.
Right. So where are you going with the company in terms of your vision or your dream of scaling it, or what you want to achieve in industry, or do you want to keep growing it across geographies? Is your mission to bring variable rate to the market in a big way? What's your kind of your vision, your core values there?
Well, I would say we've taken a fairly conservative approach, slow and steady. We don't have any outside investors or venture capital. So we've basically feel like the Crop Pro consulting company is going to stay in Western Canada. That's where our roots are, where our agronomy expertise will be. And then in other areas, we're basically licensing our software and our process to other agronomists and companies to go out and do the same thing as us. And we're being fairly selective, I would say, on who we partner with, because I would view the ability to understand the technology and the mapping and doing things right from the, what I call the geek side of the business is equally important as the agronomy side of the business, having people that know what they're doing, know, you know, what the different maps are telling you, know what the different layers are for and how to identify and make good recommendations. And so we're being quite selective of that. It's pretty much solid. They have to be solid agronomists. They have to have solid agronomists in place.
Mm-hmm.
The technology can be taught, but the agronomy has to be super strong at a local level. I'm way better off going to Southern Manitoba and dealing with field-to-field ag. You know, Jason and Troy are there, or Terra Ag, and
great guys.
And you know, Southern Manitoba as well, and saying, "Well, you guys are the experts in the agronomy down here. So, or if you're interested in swap maps, let us know if you want to offer them to your customers."
Yeah, I seen that. They're pretty excited about that. That's cool. That's fun.
And then there's nothing we can't. You know, we're not pushing people to do this. I mean, I did this myself as an independent consultant. You let them grow at their own pace, and that's kind of a non-pressure.
How coachable are producers? And I guess there's probably the odd person in general that you can't coach. How do you find that? I mean, it's one thing to give advice, but if they don't take it, it's pretty tough, eh?
Well, in the precision ag very worried space, I would say almost all the time people are expecting a sales pitch. And so their attitude generally is, well, prove to me that it works because I'm not sold. And which is not the way that we do business, right? So if we don't have the farmers buy in that this is a process and we need their feedback, right? They're on this land all the time, and we're business partners in this venture to say, look, we're trying to do the best job that we can. And as you get going, it's like, I say this all the time. If you give me three fields on your farm and you got the odds are one of them is going to have no response to variable rate this year. One of them will be small and one of them will be big, because that's how it works, right? So quite often people give you one field and then they'll say, you know, well, if you don't beat my other fields, then variable rate doesn't work. And that's, you know, does every canola field yield 50 every year? So the challenge more is when you build a map of a field and you show them, look, here's the fertility variability, right? You should probably take your nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur out of these saline depressions and put that on these hills that are showing deficient. That concept should work for the guy.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You don't. So mostly I think the first year, usually as people are very standoffish, they kind of don't buy in that this is a process and that you're trying to work with them to better their farm. They feel like it should provide a return of this dollars an acre or you're gone, you know, and that's not in fact how it should work. Like the customers that we've worked with for 10 years, it just keeps getting, what I always say is it's little things, right? Little changes every year incrementally over time, 10 years down the road, you're like, wow, we have really done some significant improvements on this farm. We've identified our issues. We're applying fertilizer in the places it pays the most. Some fields have gotten way better. Other fields, we've saved a little bit of money. You know, our crops are more even. We've increased, you know, if there's seed growers up, they just want even crops. You know, they don't care if they lose 2 bushels an acre and they're waiting another week to bring their crop in. Everyone's goals are different. So I find that after they get through maybe 1 year where they buy into how hard we're working to try and better their farm, that whole it doesn't pay discussion is just disappears. And they start to buy in that this is a process. We want to work together to get the best, you know, best final product that we can.
So you don't really deal off ROIs, but what are you thinking farmers are kind of missing that they could change this spring the easiest to kind of get the most return on? Does that make sense as a precision ag?
Well, it's not that we don't deal on ROIs, but it's, I'll ask you this question. What was, people just assume that they have the right fertility budget and they're applying things correctly right now. What was your ROI on fertilizer last year on your farm? They don't know. They don't have a number. They don't know if they applied the right rate of phosphorus or the right rate of number, nitrogen or sulfur.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So the challenge is, like, I can give them a map and I can go and soil test it and show them areas of their farm that are deficient and areas that have excess nutrients. And also clearly show the productivity of the soils. If they have yield maps, we can even take those and say, well, just take a look. I mean, you can see long term, these areas are consistently unproductive. Or these areas are consistently productive, right? So if I just reallocate all those things and the plan makes total sense to a person, they make more money, right? They see it. They know it. The problem is a farmer will never tell you that. Right? They never want to tell you.
What do you mean the farmer will tell you that?
Well, if they tell you they made money, then you might increase your fees.
Oh, yeah. No, I've never heard that. I've never heard that in the industry ever.
Really?
That guys made more money. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. No, I mean,
right.
The biggest challenge is right now that I would say people have no clue if their current fertilizer rate is right. When we had that project at Malfort in 2002 and 2003, we had 10 producer sites and three main sites on our project. We had 13 sites and we did nitrogen rate experiments. So we had zero nitrogen and all the way up to people's field rate and then an increasing rate. And guess what the rate that paid the most in 2002 and 2003 was?
What is this, multiple choice? What was the rate?
No, I gave you the answer.
Oh, you gave me the answer. Well, now I look.
The right rate was zero. Zero nitrogen.
What? Oh.
It was all replicated trials.
Wait a minute. What?
It was drier years. People grew 40 bushels of canola with 80 pounds of N, and they grew 35 bushels of canola with zero N. Nobody believed it, but that's the way it was. And that's the way fertility is. Like most people, they have no clue if what they do right now is right.
Was this study suppressed by major corporate interests in America?
No, there was zero. I wish it was. I was the agronomist on the project. Trust me, it was. I was shocked. I felt like I'd been lied to at university.
Well, we all were. Just
and then you know what the funny thing was? Because we soil tested them all. So we went back to those sites and I said, well, if the right rate was zero, then on those sites that the whole field got 80 pounds. So we go out and test those different zones in the field, that excess nitrogen should mostly show up because the crop didn't use it and it was drier year and it didn't. There was no difference between the residual nitrogen on the zero strips and the 80 N strips.
So we don't need the Haber-Bosch process.
No, it's not what I'm saying. Because 2 years later, we did those same trials and the right rate of nitrogen was the high rate.
Yeah.
The zero was like a yellow strip through the field. But those were wet years.
Yeah.
Okay. So the point that I'm trying to make here is, do you not have dry parts of your field and wet parts of your field? Do you have any clue what your response is across the landscape? Do you have any clue what the right nitrogen rate was on your farm last year? You don't know.
I don't. I don't have any.
So I'm under all kinds of scrutiny because I vary rates. But I've been doing this for 10 years.
I love it. Maverick. I just think we need to call it something else to get rid of all these connotations. But I just had this conversation with Jeff Bennett. He didn't agree with me. We disagreed. He didn't really think benchmarking data right now is an actionable thing. I think that was kind of his argument. Aren't we on the threshold of being able to collect enough data over a large enough area on specifics like varieties sweet spots for N, you know, everything under the sun, be able to make actionable decisions on that, that'll matter, whether it's, you know, whatever company it's from.
Yeah, I don't think on variety data. I mean, is that the specific topic you want to pick on? Like, I guess you almost have to go through them individually as to what want to talk about. Like, if you want to talk about scale of farms, 1,000 acres versus 10 or 50, and say benchmarking, I'm sure you could pull something out of there. You know, or people's machinery cost per acre and benchmarking. Lots of those things I would think would be have a direct effect. But when it comes to something like varieties, I would say we're nowhere near having the amount of data we need to do varieties.
Oh, okay. Interesting. So what about something like, you know, rate of nitrogen? Can that be benchmarked at sweet spot? Like, okay, we get it. Everything's, you know, there's all these nuances in the field and then these different things, but on average with a large enough data set, what is 140 pounds a sweet spot for N? I mean,
yeah, we don't have enough data that being collected to answer that question.
I feel like I kind of lost that argument then. You know, I may have to like revisit it in like 5 years or something, but I think on a long enough timeline, I hope I'm right. I mean, what I'm hoping is that, and I see you guys are doing it, but you know, you're obviously not working with every producer in Western Canada and probably everybody needs this kind of support. But I think there's a huge challenge for producers, like all the things to make decisions on, like just 50,000 of it. And as a person supplying different things to the market over time, I think people get exhausted by the end of it all. And the more things can be simplified in terms of decision-making from good data or information or education or agronomy like you guys have, the better. And I just was curious when that stuff's going to become more automated in a meaningful way.
Yeah, there's too many other factors at play. Like, because we're in the fields constantly, something like variety, what you tend to have is like a producer grows, you know, farmer A grows all in vigor this year and farmer B's growing all, you know, some Roundup Ready variety. And farmer B sprays his Roundup Ready canola once and farmer A sprays his twice and farmer B has all kinds of weeds in his field and should have sprayed it three times. You know, farmer A
seeding till June.
Farmer A does a fantastic job of seeding. Things are even. He's got excellent straw management. Management is a huge factor. Farmer B just kind of went in and then a mile an hour too fast because he had too many acres to cover. And most of the time I find the differences between people's varieties when it's between farms, if it's on a single farm, a variety comparison is probably a pretty good thing. If they're roughly seeded the same time, same type of ground and stuff. But if it's between farms and you're benchmarking between farms, it's almost always management related.
Huge differences, eh? Alyssa, I feel like I'm losing this argument. Like, how do you feel I'm scoring with these guys? Both of these guys say there's too many variables, but I'm wondering, it's sort of like macro data on the internet. Like, if I'm Googling something, that all gets noted and stored and they use it like Facebook or whatever, and they're not going to pick out single people. But if you have enough people trending or Googling like the macro data, and if, I don't know, like how many acres of Invigor canola are there? So I'm wondering, does it matter if these people are good farmers, bad farmers, if we have millions of acres in one variety versus another? Wouldn't there be enough data to say, well, this variety has inherently across all configurations and possible variables for producers, you know, two more bushels or five more bushels than the rest of the competitors on the market? I don't know. That's kind of, I heard, my understanding is this data is coming, but it's kind of interesting to get your perspective because you're a data guy. It'd be very hard to argue with you in terms of science.
We hope that you are enjoying this episode of the Growing the Future podcast. Please take the time to visit our sponsor,
Eberhart Ag Solutions at eberhartagsolutions.ca, where you can find innovative solutions that transform your farm. And now, back to the show.
Well, how do you verify the yields are even right? Like,
yeah,
you know, like, I don't know. I mean, I see people growing the same varieties, and one guy will pull off 70 bushels of canola in his fields, and the next guy's getting 45 on the same variety.
I think if you put
many other factors at play, like, it's just,
if you put
the guy growing 45 thinks it's great. Right. And so you can say, well, yeah, I mean, but farmers can't, there's structured data and there's unstructured data. Okay. And everything, when we talk about benchmarking things,
mm-hmm.
and we talk about precision ag and everything to do with technology, we have structured data, right? Things are entered. You have a map with yields on it. You have someone's entered in weights of things. Okay. But the unstructured data is what we work with all the time. We take pictures of people's crops as they're growing. We walk out, we make observations, right? So the unstructured data is all, no one has any.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's where the biggest challenge is. The unstructured data is things like, we can have pictures of guys seeded their crop the same day, and one guy's in bigger plants are this big, and the next guy's are this.
Right.
Why? What's the difference? What did he do different? Well, he seeded shallower. He only put 15 pounds of phosphate with the seed and the rest in the mid-row band. He, you know, his field was a little blacker because he harrowed the snot out of it before he seeded. And, you know, like, there's all these things that come into play. And at the end of the year, he grows more grain than the next guy. And so every year we know why he succeeded, because we saw these things. And it's all unstructured data. It's not captured in any way to say, what are the real reasons behind a variety's success or failure? And I always use this as an example with soybeans. The North Dakota State did a research with 5 different soybean varieties. And it's all dry land. And then, so one side, they just left it dry land. On the other side, they irrigated it out of the snot out of it to simulate flooding. Okay, the variety that was the best under dry land was the worst under the flooding scenario. Okay, so what about wet years versus dry years? Do we know? Well, nobody screens any varieties to know this variety is better in a wet climate, this one's variety is better in a dry climate. We just take all them, put it all together. It doesn't matter if a guy had 2 inches of rain or 20 inches of rain, it's a variety.
Yeah.
Like, there's way too much stuff going on to say a variety is better or not better. So
interesting.
I guess I'm still beating you up, Dan. I think I'm...
I want to win this. I want to bring on some guests that agree with me.
Well, you just get someone that's selling data for decision
making. Oh, don't be like that. Well, it is interesting that you say you have no salesmen. And I mean, yeah. I mean, I would argue that. We're always selling. It's just some people want to admit it or not, but you do make some good points. So in the mix of what farmers focus on in general, do you think farmers are focusing enough and investing enough on agronomy versus equipment or accounting or marketing or HR? How do you feel about that as somebody who's embedded deep in the industry?
Yeah, I would say that's very farmer specific.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think you can pick agronomy and precision ag out of the pot and say, you know, specifically that's a superstar where if people, you know, that's the kernel, you know, that's the magic thing that if you change on your farm, you become profitable. I would see that everything needs to be managed to its peak resources.
Mm-hmm.
You know, lots of times we go to people's farms and we're mapping a field and I can tell, you know, the stubble's all thin and it's full of weeds and all we think to ourselves is, why are we here? You know, like, he's got other things he needs to manage before he needs to worry about variable rate. Like, it's like an upper level management thing. Like, get all the other things running well, then go and start micromanaging. So, no, I would say almost every farmer, there's some farmers are obviously superstars, right? I mean, we definitely would have, I would say, probably we are a little bit lucky and we get to work with more superstars than other people because we are kind of offering a high level management service. But I would not pick one specific thing. I would say whether it's grain marketing or financial management or, you know, agronomy or...
How many percentage, what percentage of producers are using a professional agronomist, would you estimate?
I don't know. 10 or 15% maybe.
Isn't that something? It's a lot of acres out there. And I guess a lot of producers might be doing it themselves, or I don't know if we segregate out, you know, the services that would come from companies that they're working with locally from a retail or line company or something like that.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, I guess I'm not surprised because farmers kind of love agronomy, you know, and it's in front of them all the time. They're always at farm meetings, at local retails, and everyone's trying to sell them and educate them on their products, and they go to farm shows. I mean, I think farmers love agronomy and they love iron. Like, they're really good at equipment, like tractors and combines and knowing what they should do, and general agronomy, the basics of it. I think they got that down pat. If they're going to hire out for a professional, they'll choose like an accountant for sure. You know, they'll start working with a professional accountant to help them with their stuff. I mean, even insurance now is becoming, people are starting to get a professional help for that. Marketing, some people just don't like it. Like, they're not into it. They don't spend enough time managing their stuff. I could see how, you know, that would be an important cog for people. For us, I think on the precision ag side, it's probably almost 95% of people will hire it out. Like, I know almost no one that's doing entirely their variable rate program on their own. You know, it's very much a specialized service. Agronomy is not a specialized service to me. It's nice to have, and it's nice to have really good people on your farm helping you out, and we do lots of that. But that doesn't mean that everyone that doesn't hire an agronomist is doing it badly, in my opinion. Lots of farmers are great at it already.
Is precision ag something that a producer would learn over time working with you guys, and eventually he might, if he has a real interest in that area, start doing it himself? Or how do you find that life cycle with customers?
Yeah, and we've got a couple people. I would say in the 10 years, and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of clients that we've worked with, we've only had like four people that almost are completely doing it on their own. So the answer is yes, people could do it on their own, but even something like soil sampling. They're busy combining. When they get off the combine, they just want the job done, right? They don't want a sampling truck and, you know. So lots of the things. And then the other thing is with, say, writing prescription files or building maps and stuff. Because you only kind of do it once every 6 months, you got to sit back down to the computer and figure out all the software and, you know, figure out how to do it. And I don't know. To me, it's just, I don't see many farmers that are geeks like that, that they want to learn the technical part really hard. They're kind of still iron and agronomy people, and they'd rather just say, just do that, like, get her done.
So what really cool technology are you working on right now that's top secret that you can tell us about confidentially?
Oh, I guess we have lots of projects on the go this year. One really exciting one, I think, is a site-specific management project on water. We're working with South Country Equipment. They've got their crop intelligence app that they use with their weather station model for water-driven yield potential, and they typically place one probe in a mid-slope of the field, just kind of like to get a field average for soil moisture down to 100 centimeters and sort of help people make decisions through the year or even under irrigation. And now we're taking the swap map and we're basically going to overlay that during the growing season to, you know, as you get a certain amount of precipitation and based on what the soil moisture probe is at, we can model, you know, maybe what the hills have for moisture and what the depressions have for moisture. And if you want to go out and add more fertilizer or invest more of something in this crop, you know, what is your yield potential, you know, based, you know, throughout the whole entire field.
So are you having a lot of guys that are split applications now based on that, or that's just coming? That's a new thing.
Yeah, we don't work with a lot of producers doing split applications, but I think that's going to change. I think stuff is getting more expensive. People are going for higher yields and protein. There's more pressure to, if you want high yields, not just, you know, pour on the fertilizer in the spring. You know, it's from an environmentally, you know, sustainable standpoint and even a use efficiency standpoint, it's not the best way to go. So yeah, I don't see that today it's a huge product, but I mean, there's thousands of weather stations out there now. So obviously the farmers are buying into it to make in-season decisions. And, you know, you might even help them predict what their yields are going to be, right, based on their soil moisture and precipitation.
You guys do a lot of physical soil testing. Do you think there's going to be technology in the near future that does that work really almost like your SWAT boxes do?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's the number one thing on my wish list, is not to soil test fields with trucks and probes.
Yeah.
And do it the conventional way. It's better than composite sampling, but it's still very time consuming, you know, a lot of labor, trucks, fuel, and still soil tests are kind of an inexact science. So yeah, there's several tools being evaluated for what I'd call on the go nutrient mapping. Some of them have promise. Some of them, I guess we'll see. I've got my fingers crossed that we can make some of these things work. So yeah, that's the next holy grail of soil fertility layers, is nutrient maps, I think.
You spend a lot of time in your company researching, reading, investigating, dreaming and scheming, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we want to keep getting better. Like, I guess we don't hide the areas of our program that are weak with people. You know, like in my opinion, zone soil sampling is definitely better than taking one sample in the field and blanket applying. But it's not, we're not there. We're not to the top end of the spectrum yet. There's still another whole layer, you know, another whole level that we can go to. Yeah. With many things. I guess that's why I mentioned the site-specific management water project. I mean, it's incrementally, I think, that everything is just, the farmer starts variable rate and he wants to just do nitrogen, I'll say, well, you mean, then you get this. Can you do phosphorus? Then you're going to get this, right? You can do sulfur, then you get a little bit more. And you can do seed and seed rates, and you get a little bit more. And then if we can add in some more technologies, like, it's a whole bunch of incremental little things.
It probably gets more cost efficient as you, I mean, you already have the data and you're already soil testing and stuff like that. Probably as many layers of management you can add to these different areas. He's back on the original investment, I would think. And
yeah, and the nice thing is when you learn one little thing, farms are so big nowadays that something that makes you an extra couple bucks an acre every year on 10,000 acres is a lot of money.
Yeah.
Right? So I'm not trying to find a way to come up and say, oh, my return on investment is 10 to 1 and I'm going to make you $50 an acre every year. Right? I just want to have proof that I can do 10 little things. Right? And on some fields, there might only be 5 of them that are going to apply. In the next field, it might be 15. But on a farm in general, you can look and say, all these little things together are going to add up to a big thing.
Do we have a lot of institutions doing a really great job of third-party data, like in the right context? Because I think context and research is everything. If you're researching something out of context, you might as well throw it out the window with last week's sandwich. I mean, don't you think?
Yeah, I would say it's still a problem and always has been, and they would admit that, right? It's really hard when you're in an institution all the time with 4 walls and a window and you're not out in the field like the farmers are or the agronomists, constantly in a learning environment to really, you know if the things that you're testing and evaluating and, you know, proposing for the future are really valid. So that hasn't changed.
Where do you get the majority of your information from nowadays? Obviously it's changed. I mean, maybe in the past it would have been textbooks or, you know, books in general, but now the internet's so ubiquitous. Like, are you just Google a lot of things, or what rabbit trails do you go on to learn?
Well, no, I would say our number one learning thing is learning on the fly.
Learning from experience, learning by doing.
Yeah, learning from experience. I mean, we have ideas of what's best, and so typically we encourage our customers and our agronomists to say, okay, here's something we think can work. Let's encourage a bunch of people to try this. Let them know it's just a trial. You know, we don't know yet if it's going to work. And go and get a bunch of people to try it and, you know, learn if it worked or not. If it sounds, you know, pretty rough around the edges, but that would be our number one thing. And that's why I mentioned earlier in the podcast about farmers recognizing that this is a process, because that's the second part of the number one thing. Number one way to learn stuff is to keep talking to the farmers about what's working and what's not. And if you work with hundreds and hundreds of farmers all the time and you start hearing the same things from some of them, that this is working and this isn't, you take note, right? So I'll use seed rates in salinity as an example. In light salinity, all the farmers love increased seed rates. You utilize more water, they get more plants established, more competition with weeds like kochia and stuff that come in. They love it. None of them have changed that. They've all stayed with it. But under severe salinity, there's some people will take chances and add more seed. Some people will cut right back and just say everything dies there. And that becomes a farmer specific thing. Some farmers in their salinity, there's no fertilizer and maybe half a seed rate. Other people still keep their seed rate up and saying, whatever, I can just keep investing seed in there. And after 5 years, let's ask this question of whether it paid, because I want to see if I can change the ground, you know? So there's a lot of these trial and error things going on where, you know, we can propose ideas, the farmers give us feedback. Doesn't sound like research to most people, but that's the way the world works in farming.
Still a scientific method, and it's probably better than most things. And, you know, I think things are changing so fast and there's so much new stuff going on in the field. I mean, that's maybe the best place to be learning. So you can't, I don't know if I can win this little point, but pick up the Western producer, and I don't probably have to go very far, and you're going to read about glyphosate. People don't want glyphosate. You know, the Canada food guy now, we're all supposed to be eating plant-based, and soil erosion costs farmers $3.1 billion a year. Like, there's a big, you can't pick up the Western producer and not hear about regenerative ag and everything. And Talk me about that. Like, what's the deal?
Yeah, I...
Or you don't have an opinion?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, I'm all for, like, new issues and, you know, recognizing that the consumers and the public has a right to know and a right to have and say and things in agriculture. I mean, government obviously has a say. They're constantly legislating different things. Industry has a say because fertilizer companies and chemical companies control a lot of the products that we buy. And so, I mean, agriculture is a very, you know, at all levels, it's got hot topics. I guess I would feel like I mostly have my farmer boots on. And most of the stuff, I can't say I become extremely interested in it.
Yeah.
It seems like very much a lot of fringe topics where, you know, I can throw around these types of things, but down here on the ground, it's still, you know what, these people are just trying to make a living like everyone else. People need to respect that, you know, if you have all the answers, then, you know, maybe you should pay the bills. Because working with farmers, and I grew up on a farm, I mean, there's a lot of tough times for these people. There's a lot of stress. There's a lot of investment, right? So it's really easy to scrutinize the agriculture industry in so many ways, but I just want what's best for the farmers. I guess from my point of view, I'm all for the farmer. And as much as I, yes, do care about the issues, and I want to make sure that we are environmentally friendly and being good stewards in so many ways, I think that those things are just, they're natural to the farming community. Like, I don't think the general public understands that sometimes the things that harm public and the food chain and the, you know, everything else, it harms, you know, farmers at the grassroots level too. So I just feel like the media is too hard on the farming community, and they're just mostly get their boots given to them all the time and all the things they need to do, and not a big fan of it.
Well said. Appreciate it. If one farmer were talking to another in the coffee shop, what would you most hope they would say about you and your company and your services and your people?
Well, I would say the number one thing that we want to be known for is just an integrity of what we're doing. So integrity is definitely at the top of the list at our company. Never lie to people. Be professional. You're out there to serve them and to do the best job for them that you can. If we don't know something, we can find out. It isn't a big deal. This isn't an ego trip. Let's just make sure 100% we have their best needs, their requirements, their bottom lines at the forefront. And I think in general, the farming industry is an honest industry. We don't have a contract with our farmers. Like, we've never had a bill that's never been paid.
Right.
I've chased a couple people that were in dire financial times, but in general, it's a handshake industry. So I believe that trust, honesty, I put those together and say integrity is everything. Just do the right thing. And if we always have that at the front of everything we do, we'll always be fine. We'll always be fine.
Love it. Well said. And we are very lucky to work in that industry. Like, it's a small fishbowl, and your capital is your word. And if you don't have that, that's one of the first things that got beat into us by the old man. I mean, no matter what, above everything else, you gotta have integrity. And if you give your word, that's your bond, and that's it. Come hell or high water.
Yeah, and that's not in every industry, you know. Like, there's not many industries that still do business on handshakes.
Yeah, I agree. We're really lucky. On one hand, we're working with some of the greatest, most exciting, newest developments in technology. There was a Twitter thing I just retweeted today. Someone said, second to only war, agriculture is the greatest innovator out there in terms of new developments for society and whatnot. I think just a tremendous amount of great things coming out of agriculture, and it's a great place to work in terms of technology. At the same time, there's a lot of old school traditional values like honesty and integrity in doing business that are still being maintained that make it really special. I love that. Yeah. I mean, used to sell $15 million of John Deere in 1 year, and I was terrible at paperwork, but I had a lot of handshakes. Like, literally really bad at paperwork and collecting down payments and whatever else. But yeah, I mean, in all the business I ever did, probably only had like one or two circumstances where a farmer sort of backed out of something, and it was in a really tough situation that you can sort of understand what had happened. But yeah, love it. Love it. And I love what you said about, hey, we're just on boots on the ground in terms of getting things done. And there is a lot of talk. There's a lot of noise. But at the end of the day, the market is signaling they sure still need what we do. Last time I checked. So anyways, there's lots more areas we could cover. Appreciate what you're doing, though, actually, in the industry and for agronomy and advocating for precision ag. It sounds like there's a lot more work to be done in terms of the educational system and research and all that, and making people aware. And I think you guys have built a beautiful business that's bringing a lot of value to the market, and be exciting to watch it grow and stay in touch. So yeah, it's very cool. I appreciate you taking the time today.
Thank you very much for having me, and it was enjoyable. Keep up the good work.
Oh, I appreciate that. Yeah. When am I going to see you next in person? Are you, I don't know.
I'm speaking at that Top Crop Manager Soil Summit.
Ooh. Okay. Top Crop,
where is that? It's at the end of the month at TCU Place in Saskatoon.
That's your next appearance, eh? Top Crop.
That's my next Saskatchewan appearance, yeah.
You're doing quite a bit of speaking this winter?
Yeah, still a fair amount, yeah.
What's that one called, Top Crop what?
The Soil Summit. I think it's...
Cool. I'll have to check that out.
26th of February.
What are you talking about there, Precision Ag, I guess, obviously?
Swap maps. That's what it's my education piece.
Have you figured out how to make a marketing video with like the SWAT team coming in on the farmer, and he's like doesn't have any precision ag, and they're like, is there a marketing angle there we can help you with? I think that'd be, I love SWAT, the name SWAT. It's just like
hardcore. Yeah, there probably is a very good marketing angle on that. Have some fun with it. Yeah. You betcha.
Good for you. Well, keep up the good work. Love what you're doing. And thanks a lot for your time. I appreciate it today, and let's stay in touch.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Corey. Take care.
Yeah, see you.
Bye now.
Thanks for listening to the Growing the Future podcast. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for highlights of the show. Also, full-length videos of the show are available on our website, www.growingthefuturepodcast.ca, and on YouTube. We would very much appreciate if you took the time to visit our sponsor, Eberhardt Ag Solutions, at eberhardtagsolutions.ca, where you can find innovative solutions that transform your farm.